Accession number 4608, reel number 2.
Air Marshal Sir Victor Groom, Reel 2. You were telling me about your initial posting to the Middle East and your time on leave in Egypt during the first 7 days.
Well, we were sitting around in the hotel, the Continental in Cairo, one evening, really wondering what on earth to do, when an Air Commodore came in. He proved to be the SASO of the headquarters Middle East.
What's SASO?
The Senior Air Staff Officer. Of headquarters Middle East. I think his name was Drew, Bertie Drew. Anyway, he saw us young officers sitting around and asked us what we were doing there. We explained why we were on leave. And he said, do you dance? Well, most of us said, no, we didn't dance. And he said, well, what are you going to do? Sit around like looking like a lot of fools, or are you going to waste your time or go in the wrong places in Cairo? So, Well, we didn't know what the answer to that was, but anyway, it certainly put an idea into my mind, which I turned into use later on, as I'll tell you. But anyway, it was shortly after that we were told that the railway was open, and off we went back to Kantara, and aboard this appalling train, which was going to take us up to Ramleh. It really was, the seats were wood, and there were drop-down bunks for some of us to sleep on, and some were sleeping on the wooden things during the night time. I don't think the journey took a hell of a long time, but I know we broke down along on the journey. One place a coupling went or something, so we had to sit and wait a long time. And it was quite cold in Palestine at that time of the year. We were still either just the end of January or the beginning of end of December or the beginning of January. Well, we arrived at Ramleh, and there was 111 squadron equipped with Bristol fighters. I remember the squadron commander's name was Rice, and I think I did actually fly while I was there, but I was only there a very short time. But I was interested when walking around from the airfield. I went and found an old potter sitting in a little cave, and I was absolutely fascinated. I'd never seen a potter at work before, and there he worked his potter's wheel with a string on his toe, and worked the revolving part of the mechanism in that way. And he was just making ordinary clay pots. But I remember that quite vividly. I've seen modern potteries at work since then. However, it wasn't very long before several of us received orders to go back to Egypt.
Can you describe the camp at Ramleh for me?
Well, it was... we were all in tents. I think the officers, we had EP tents. Those are the square tents, and quite large. And the whole camp was tented. And it was on the side of a hill, very uncomfortable, very cold, oil stoves, my recollection is. I haven't got a very vivid recollection of the place, and I don't think I was there very long altogether. No, I wasn't there very long. I was posted there with effect from the 15th of December, but of course we didn't get there, because some of it was in Cairo. And I see that on the 1st of... on the 6th of January, I was posted to 142 Squadron, which was at Suez. So I was only there probably about a week in Palestine altogether.
Were there many RAF personnel at Ramleh?
It was one squadron, a full squadron. So I can't remember how many bodies that was. Wasn't very many in those days.
When the squadron moved, did all the personnel move?
Oh, no, the squadron didn't move. It was only a few of us who were taken away from one squadron and told to go to Egypt. And I'll explain. We were posted to Suez, and stationed at Suez that time was 142 Squadron. It only consisted of one flight, Of course, everything in the Air Force had been run down at this stage. It only consisted of one flight, commanded by a chap named Flight Lieutenant Elliot Smith. It was equipped with DH-9 aeroplanes, a two-seater theoretical bomber, with a Napier Lion engine. The airfield was nothing more than a flat bit of desert, a few miles north of Suez. We lived in huts. The officers lived in huts. I can't remember where the airmen lived. And the hangars were canvas. And as I say, it was only one flight at that time. Now, we didn't know, but obviously there was a long-term view being taken by behind us at the headquarters, because it wasn't very long. In fact, it was on the 1st of February that 142 Squadron, so-called, was converted to 55 Squadron. They were abolishing the numbers of less distinguished squadrons and reintroducing squadrons which had a good name in the Air Force. And 55 Squadron was a very celebrated squadron in France. And what they did, of course, is they folded up squadrons and demobilized them at home and then reintroduced the number somewhere else. My old squadron, 20 Squadron, was resurrected in India, for instance, and became 20 Squadron in India. Anyway, 142 Squadron then became 55 Squadron and was gradually brought up to squadron strength. A new chap arrived to command it, Squadron Leader C.H. Nicholas. And we weren't doing anything in particular at that time. We were flying occasionally, but nothing serious. We used to go down and play golf near Suez on an ordinary sandy golf course with browns and no greens, of course. And on the Saturday nights, we used to go across to Port Tewfik, which was over the causeway from Suez, to the French club, where they used to hold a dance every Saturday night. Now, I've already told you that when we were in Cairo, most of us didn't dance. But there was a very charming wife of a padre, an army padre, in Suez at the time, and she decided to start dancing classes for young officers. And so several of us joined this class, and I remember doing our 1, 2, 3 straight up and down the floor and learning how to waltz. I should explain that just outside Suez at that time was a very large transit camp for Indian Army regiments who were being evacuated both from the Middle East and from Europe back to India. But of course the amount of shipping which was available was very small in those days, and people waited in this camp for a very considerable time while the ships went back to and forwards to India. And so a lot of these Indian Army officers, British officers with Indian Army regiments, had their wives out in Suez, and of course they formed estimable dancing partners. And there were two hospitals in Suez at the time, an Indian hospital and a British hospital, all tents, of course. I had an experience in while I was there of being in one of them. And but anyway, the nurses, some of them whom were half-caste, Chichis we used to call them, with the Indian hospital, and most of their nurses were the half-caste Indians. But of course the British nurses from the British hospital as well. And that's how I learnt to dance, and it stood me in good stead ever afterwards. Now, to go back to the squadron itself, we used to fly very little, but we played games, and one of the great sources of attraction in those days was the officers from the ships, who these transports that were coming in and taking the troops back to India. They would get up a team and come out and play us at football or golf or all sorts of things. And in return, they would invite some of us aboard to have a damn good dinner. They fared much better in the troop ships, of course, than we did in the officers' mess on shore. Well, now, it wasn't long.
Did you do any operational flying for the...
No, we did no operational flying at all at that time. There was nothing to operate against.
What about in with the Navy? Did you...
No, there weren't any... Well, I remember there was a submarine came once there, and of course we used to see ships going through the canal, a few, but not battle boats.
Any flights down the Gulf of Suez?
Yes, we did occasionally. I remember taking... an inspector of ports and lights or something, I think he was called, flying him down the Gulf of Suez to have a look from the air at the various lighthouses and things at that time. But there was no operational flying in the ordinary accepted sense of the thing. And most of it was just joyriding, virtually.
Did you have lots of time in the air?
No, we didn't do a lot of flying. Unfortunately, I haven't got my logbooks, either the first war or that early period at Suez. When we were posted from Suez, as we did go very suddenly, my logbooks were my books, and I hadn't got any possibility of packing up books to take with me off to Turkey where we were going. And I just left everything in the bookcases in my hut. And with it, my first war logbook. And of that period when I was Jewish. So I haven't got that, and my logbooks that I've got now don't start until I was in Iraq.
Where did you spend most of your off-duty time in Suez?
Well, there was a hotel called the Bel Air where we used to go and sit on the veranda and watch the populace go by, which was near the railway station at Suez, and we used to dine there occasionally and get very indifferent dinners. As I say, the Saturday night do in the French club at Port Tewfik was the great highlight of the thing. The rest of the time we was either playing tennis or golf or something of that sort. An occasional guest night in the mess when we used to entertain the officers from the Indian Transit Camp. And a favourite pastime on those occasions was a terrible thing called Cardinal Puff.
What's that?
Well, Cardinal Puff was the thing where you had a team of three chaps who were the judges, and the chairman of this team would go through a paraphernalia saying, "I drink to the health of Cardinal Puff once," and he'd tap the side of his nose with his finger, and then he'd have a drink. Then, "I drink to the health of Cardinal Puff twice," and he'd do it with two fingers on the other side of the nose. And he'd go through various things of this sort until you got up to about six. And in the course of this, you were either tapping on the table with one finger or two fingers and underneath it. And if you made a mistake, you, the candidate, were sitting opposite this team, and the chairman would go through it once, and then you'd have to copy him. But if you made a mistake, you had to drink your drink straight up and start all over again. So you can imagine that unless you had a very hard head, you either had to give up the game or else you were under the table. And this was a favourite thing that was played on guest nights in the mess. I was a sufferer from that on one occasion. I well remember I didn't compete. I wasn't able to complete it at all. And felt very ill the next day as a result of it. However, those are the silly things you do when you're young.
What about the more official side of life? What sort of duties did the pilots have to perform in Egypt? Was it just flying, or did they have technical...
No, well, in those days we had no technical officers in the Air Force at all. And so every GD officer, everybody who flew, had to do something else. Now, I was made to be the armament officer. Why, I don't know, except that I'd fired a gun in the air and knew how to maintain it. I'd learnt when I was at the School of Military Aeronautics, but I didn't know much else about it. But so we all had to do something, and I was made the armament officer. Now, the armoury was in a Nissen hut, and the airmen, for security's sake, were three airmen, used to sleep in this hut. There was a sergeant armourer, who, of course, slept in the sergeant's mess or wherever that was. I'm very hazy about what happened about the troops in those days. I wasn't a flight commander, and I had no responsibilities apart from being the armoured officer and a chap in a flight who flew an aeroplane for no particular reason at all, as far as I can remember. Anyway, we were given orders to make a list of spares we would require for the squadron if it was ordered away We didn't know where or whatever for. So with the aid of the flight sergeant, who knew more, or the sergeant who knew more about it than I did, we sat down to make a list of spares that we ought to pack up in cases to take with us on the armament side. I was quite ignorant about all these things, but I remember going into the mission hut one morning. As I told you, the airman slept in there, and there was an airman in bed. It was quite early in the morning, and suspended over him, hanging down on the end of a thread, was a large tarantula spider. Well, the tarantula spider is very, very poisonous, as you can imagine. And I didn't know what to do. There was the airman fast asleep. However, I managed to get hold of something and luckily took a swipe at this thing and hit it and woke the airman up quickly. How we killed or disposed of the spider, I can't for life me remember, but this made a great impression on me at the time, frightened me rather. However, we received orders in the end and were told that we were going to be sent to Turkey.
Did you keep your DH-9s at this time?
Yes, we had nothing but DH-9s at this time. And when we were told that we were going to Turkey, we were told also that we were going to be equipped with DH-9As. Now, a 9A was a form of DH-4 brought more up to date. It had a Liberty engine with the Delco Remy ignition, rather different from the elementary. Delco Remy ignition is more like a modern ignition system working through a battery, an electric battery, rather than just a magneto, which of course was much more difficult to get a spark to start with, so on and so forth. Now, Maxwell, who was my flight commander, Robert Reginald Stewart Maxwell, flight lieutenant, went off to Alexandria to the aircraft depot and brought back a DH-9A. He'd been given some instruction on it at the depot, and he brought it back, and then he suddenly said to us, well, get in and fly it. Well, I didn't like the idea of this very much. I said, well, I'd like to know something about it first. Tell me about the ignition system. He didn't even understand it himself, I don't think, but it shows you how elementary the whole system was. Came the day when we only had that one DH-9A at Suez. We were packed up to go off to Alexandria. All these spares, of which we made a list so carefully, were gathered together and put into packing cases, presumably. I don't know. I really don't know how the damn thing was organized at all. I'm very ignorant about what was going on. Nobody ever told us anything in those days, you know. I learned a lot of lessons, suited me later on in my more senior occasions, from the horrible way we were treated in those days and left in complete ignorance of what was going on. But we went by train, my recollection is, to Alexandria, and there were two old boats, and the one we embarked in was called Tambov, I think it was. Yeah, Tambu. SSMT Tambu, T-A-M-B-O-O.
Before we get on to Asia Minor, could you tell me about the health and medical care in Suez at the time?
Well, we had a medical officer at Suez, a chap named Tomlinson. But I don't remember anything about sick quarters. I suppose I wasn't ill and I never thought about it. I know more about it later on, as I'll be able to tell you. I remember, of course. One bit. I was told you at that time I was in 21 or 20, and I had terrible trouble. I had to be circumcised, and I was taken into the British hospital in Suez somewhere, which was nothing but a collection of tents, and very elementary it was too. I was eventually taken into the tent, which was the operating theatre, laid out on a bed, and a chap stood beside me with a bowl, which I presume was ether or something of that sort. He put a flannel in this and he just spread this across my nose and my mouth, and I was made to breathe this in. And I remember Catherine wheels and things going round in my head. And while this was all going on, I was circumcised. And then put back into bed with a lot of stitches in me. And what agonies I suffered. I was only fortunately in there a few days. But it was all so elementary, and dust and sand and everything was all over the place. How the devil we didn't get poisoned or whatever happens to you in these occasions, I don't know. But it was most elementary, the whole thing. And back I went to the squadron again after that. Oh, no, I was given some leave, and I went off to Alexandria for a few days. And there I learnt my first lesson about the sun, and it made me frightened of it ever after, because I was lying around on the beach without any oil or anything of that on my skin, and I got very, very badly burned indeed. And on my journey back to Suez by train from Alexandria, I was in absolute agony in my clothes. But I didn't get much help when I got back to the squadron from the doctor there either, who just smeared some stuff on my back, but it didn't do much good. And the skin came off in great lumps off me. But fortunately, this happened some time before we moved off to Alexandria for our embarkation to Turkey.
When you first went out to the Middle East, how long did you anticipate serving there?
Oh, I don't think one was told anything about this. You see, having been given a permanent commission in 1919, they were anxious to get the chaps home who weren't given permanent commissions, and the object of the exercise was to send us out there to relieve these chaps so they could come home and be demobilised. But one didn't think about that at all. There was no accepted tour of duty abroad at that time, as there was afterwards. And one wasn't told anything, as I say. One was just told, off you go to the Middle East. And anyway, I was delighted. I liked the sunshine. And it was all fascinating. I loved, seeing foreign parts as they were. I remember how careful one had to be in dealing with the locals. I remember walking along a street with friends of mine when little Arab boys would throw stones at us, but one wasn't allowed to do anything in return or retaliate against them because the orders were very, very strict about our relationships with the natives, and we kept them at arm's length. It was at one time when I was in Alexandria. It could have been while I was on that sick leave, or it may have been by the time when we first arrived and we were put up in a hotel pending a train going off, but the Prince of Wales, Edward VIII was afterwards, of course, came out about that time. And he was staying in a hotel, not the same one that we were in. And there were demonstrations by the Arabs against him, marching up and down outside the hotel. And indeed, we were told to stay indoors on this occasion while these sort of demonstrations were going on. But I knew nothing about politics. I knew nothing about relationships with the natives or anything else. And I just enjoyed seeing them. And, something all so new and lovely warm weather. That's the best part of it all.
Did you learn anything in advance about the Middle East?
I knew absolutely nothing about the Middle East, really, apart from my general geography lessons I learnt at school. And I must have known about the pyramids and this sort of thing, though I didn't really have any time to go and see those during that period. I made up for it later. But I knew very little about the thing, or even about the war in the Middle East at that stage. I only learnt about things afterwards, about the Allenby campaigns and all these sort of things. I knew nothing. I was quite ignorant about anything. One lived in a little circle of one's own and within the squadron and did what one was told and never questioned anything. You just did it and got on with it, whatever you were told to do. One ran nothing. One had no authority. One did. No, just enjoy one was allowed to fly, and that was it.
Well, did the Air Force tell you about flying conditions in Egypt or any other technical information like that before you arrived?
No, my recollection is that we just found out for yourself. I suppose there must have been some discussion in the mess with people who'd been out there longer than we had. My recollection at that time, and I must have been there during the Khamseen period, because I was in Suez from the end of, from January until July, and the Khamseen blows in February and March, if my recollection is right, and so one must have experienced it. I do remember the lovely sunrises over Sinai and the sunsets over the Macadam Hills to the west from Suez. And of course there was an oil refinery at Suez which used to blow terrible smells over us when the wind was blowing from the west. But no, when I was, of course my memory is fallible, but my recollection is that one just went on daily without questioning anything and without being too inquisitive.
How many army personnel were at Suez?
Oh, I can't tell you the answer to that. My recollection there was it was only the transit camp for the Indian Army going back to India. There was no British regiment in the area as such stationed there.
When did you leave Egypt on the way to Turkey?
We sailed, I see, from my record, we sailed in Tambu. We embarked at Alexandria on the 7th of July, 1920.
Could you describe the journey?
Well, the boats were very small, as boats go. Now, 55 Squadron was part of a force called Q Force, commanded by Wing Commander Fellows. It consisted only of 55 Squadron, but also with an aircraft park.
What's an aircraft park?
Well, an aircraft park is the thing that which keeps all the spares and supplies. It's a smaller edition of a depot. And normally, a park goes forward with the squadrons, and it receives stuff specially for the squadrons of its area, its wing, or whatever it is, and only those. Whereas a depot receives things for a whole command, probably. The place at Alexandria was responsible for all the air forces in the Middle East Command, which would include Iraq as well in those days. But the aircraft park went with us to Turkey to supply just our needs. It seems an awful waste to me now, looking back on it, to have a whole aircraft park just for one squadron. There was no other squadron in Turkey at that time, except the Navy, who had seaplanes, which we virtually replaced. Anyway, we embarked in this little boat, terribly crowded. I never knew why we were going there at that time at all. And I can't remember how long it took us to get to Constantinople. Actually, we went up through, of course, through the past the Gallipoli business, which was all very much in our minds. I got a recollection that somebody did tell us about Gallipoli as we went through. But anyway, we went on to a place called Fenerake, which is opposite Constantinople on the Asia Minor side. And there we were unloaded. Now, I should explain that through no action on part of the squadron, aeroplanes were delivered to the ship as part of the aircraft park, and I presume they went in the other ship. They certainly didn't go the one in we were in. But all this stuff was unloaded at Fenerake. We weren't there very long, but a train was brought alongside with a lot of floats, you know, flat things on wheels, on which all the aeroplane cases were loaded, and all the spare parts and everything else. And carriages were attached to this, into which we got. And off we went, not very far, I can't remember how far, at night time. And we were stopped on a railway. There was no siding, and there was a mechanical crane came alongside on the other rail, But they had to stop all the trains going that way because there was no siding for us. And while all this was going on, all the normal train services into Asia Minor were halted. I've got a feeling then the trains were run by the soldiery. I can't remember. Anyway, we were unloaded. At night, everything just dumped alongside the railway line. And then the train was shunted off and normal things went on, I suppose. We must have had some form of lighting because we unpacked everything by the side of the railway and erected, as far as I can remember, the aeroplanes there and then. We were actually at a place called Maltepe, M-A-L-T-E-P-E, and we had to have everything with us, tents. We were a tented camp, of course, and it was a polo ground, really, in peacetime. But of course, aeroplanes didn't take much room in those days. Our airfields, at the best, were never more than 400 yards square, and a polo field, I suppose, was the most suitable thing that they could have found for us. Anyway, we were in the course of erecting things at this camp when an irate Major General rode up with an ADC and said, "What the hell are you doing here? You can't do anything here. You're in front of my troops. You're in the front line." Well, we didn't know there was any enemy at that stage. And in fact, I didn't know what it was all about at all. But anyway, we said, "Well, we're here and we can't move our aeroplanes anywhere else. We've got to have this flat bit of ground on which to take them off. There's only one thing for you to do is to remove your troops." At least the CO said this to the general, and presumably he did, because we went on there at Maltepe. I didn't go on there very long because I ran a foul temperature, tremendous temperature. Now, we had a doctor named Canton. He was an Irishman, a Roman Catholic, slightly mad. And I'd been bathing down at we were right on the coast, and I'd been bathing, and I came back with this raging temperature, of course, in a tent, on a camp bed, of course.